Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and events are moving rapidly around the coronavirus and our response. Later in the hour, we will take your latest questions with our daily panel of healthcare professionals, and we'll also bring you Governor Charlie Baker's daily press briefing live. If you have a question for our healthcare panel, call 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. First, as most of us were sleeping last night, Congress thought it had reached a deal with the White House on a $2 trillion stimulus package. Today, though, three Republican senators expressed concerns about a major drafting error in the bill and said they'd oppose it being fast-tracked for passage. Joining us on the line to talk about all of this is Massachusetts Congresswoman Lori Trahan. Congresswoman Trahan, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Hi, Tiziana. It's nice to be back. Thank you.
And Congresswoman, I want to talk about the stimulus bill, but a number of other things have happened just in the last several minutes, and I want to talk to you about those quickly. Shortly before we went on air, we learned that Congressman Seth Moulton of the Commonwealth here has self-quarantined on doctor's orders after experiencing symptoms of COVID-19, such as fever, tightness in his chest. He has not been tested. Have you spoken with Representative Moulton, and did you know that he was experiencing symptoms?
No, you know, I actually learned the same way you did. And so, you know, obviously we're, you know, concerned and thinking about Congressman Moulton. And as you know, there are now a number of members of the House who are self-quarantined or self-isolating. And we have a couple of members who are tested positive. And so, you know, we're hoping that he recovers quickly and that his test, if and when he takes one, comes back negative.
So to your point, and our concerns do go out to the congressman, we will be thinking about him. It raises questions about the spread, further spread among the House. What procedures are in place in the House now, and what else are you thinking about that you think may be necessary?
Well, as you know, a couple of weeks ago, I came out in support of emergency remote voting for just this reason. I mean, when you're a new House member, you're a bit surprised at the fact that after 9/11, that some of those systems and procedures weren't put in place. And, you know, it's an open question. I am prepared, obviously, to jump into my car and drive down to Washington to take that very important vote when the time comes. But, you know, there are a number of members who, one, aren't in that position, and two, are going to put their health at risk. You know, over 40% of the members in the House of Representatives are over 60 years of age, and I think we're putting their health in danger by having them come back to Washington to vote.
I know this is a hard question to answer. You know, your Massachusetts colleague, Congressman Jim McGovern, chair of the Rules Committee, has said he thinks it's unlikely that the House can adopt rules in time that would allow for something like, say, remote voting. So what do you do? I mean, the reality of the spread is there. I know you said, yeah, I'll get in my car. Can Congress continue to function? Are we facing the possibility of a constitutional crisis at some point?
You know, I respect Chairman McGovern because I know that if there was a way for him to use the rules process to put this in place, he would have come up with that. But there isn't, right? This would have had to have been put into place long ago. And so our options are limited. I do think that we should consider after this vote or during this vote while we're voting, having a discussion to put the logistics in place. You know, this is not going to be the last package we vote on. And so if you consider that it's only going to get more intense after today, it would behoove us to put some safety precautions in place for our members who are in California and Hawaii and, of course, are older.
We're on the line with Congresswoman Lori Trahan. Congresswoman, also right before we went on the air, Massachusetts Representative Joe Kennedy, your colleague, called for a nationwide stay-at-home order, saying that it's the only way the pandemic ends. Do you support that with him?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, I joined with Representative Ro Khanna from California, sending a letter to the president to put in place a mandatory two-week nationwide shelter in place to blunt the spread of the virus. I mean, every health official, epidemiologist, economist that I've talked to in the last few weeks, they've made it abundantly clear that we must deal with the health crisis in a bold and decisive way if we're going to save lives and if we're going to mitigate the economic impact. And so, you know, the president standing before, you know, in front of a podium touting his tremendous job or setting an expectation that we're going to be open for Easter, it's irresponsible and, frankly, it's dangerous. We need long-term, courageous thinkers here, people who are willing to execute some tough decisions for the health of our country.
Underscoring your point that yesterday the president said he'd like the economy essentially to be open for business by Easter, how do we get to a point where our national leadership across the branches of government are in the same place in order to make sure the country gets where it needs to be on this pandemic?
You know, I try not to get too frustrated or too disillusioned because I'm reminded of all the time is what happens at a community level. You know, the reality is we all have a duty. We all have a role to play. And we've seen that when we play that role, when we exercise social distancing and coughing into our sleeve and washing our hands and not interacting with our parents and our grandparents the way we're so used to, we actually can stem or flatten the curve. And I think it's so important that folks are reminded that they are empowered to take these matters into their hands. If we're going to keep ourselves and our families safe and healthy, especially our seniors and immune compromised, we all have to take action. I mean, we're all doing it. I'm certainly not special in this regard, but we've all had to adjust our lifestyles in an effort to flatten that curve, and it has to continue. And I think we have to continue to put pressure on, you know, the states and the governors who haven't executed that, and certainly on our president.
So I'd like to shift and talk about the stimulus package for a minute, Congresswoman. It looked at least like the Senate was moving forward after last night, after some tense negotiations. You know, some of the key features are a $1,200 direct payment to people with incomes below $75,000, extended unemployment coverage, federally guaranteed loans to small businesses who promise not to lay off workers, $500 billion in loans to large corporations. As it came out last night, were you satisfied with the final compromise bill?
You know, of course, these packages aren't, they're not perfect. Would I have liked to see, more, an increase in Medicaid funding? Would I have liked to have seen an increase in, you know, broadband infrastructure so that every community has access to the remote learning that our school districts are forced into? Of course. I didn't see everything I wanted. I lobbied hard for increased funding for community service block grants and for our child care block grants, and but they were funded. And so I think when you net it all out, and we are still evaluating and reading through the pages to see exactly where the delta is between our proposal and the bipartisan Senate proposal. We're going to continue to see where the gaps are. But for, you know, the most part, it is so important that we move swiftly and simply in the interests of the American people. I mean, this is about saving lives. It's about supporting our workers, our families, and our small businesses that are so essential to our economy. And I think this is a comprehensive package that gets us there.
You talked about the importance of moving quickly. You know, to that point, at about 2 o'clock this afternoon, Senator Lindsey Graham and a couple of colleagues held a press conference saying that the unemployment package here incentivizes people not to go back to work because it actually will pay people more than they may earn in their jobs, and that they want an amendment and are not supporting fast tracking this. So what does that mean now for the fate of this package?
You know, it's unclear. It's unfortunate that, you know, Senate Democrats, you know, worked to improve this deal with Leader McConnell and Secretary Mnuchin. And now there's dissension in those Republican ranks because I do think it was hard to get to this point in an expedient way. I think it's very cynical of Senator Graham to think that folks are going to be taking advantage of unemployment insurance. I mean, the reality is we have so many people who are getting laid off and furloughed that we've never seen this type of you know, devastation in the workplace. And so we have to put in place expanded benefits that, you know, get up to 100% of wage replacement for a period of time where folks can get back on their feet. And for the senator to have a flag around this is just an opportunity for people to take advantage. It's telling in terms of where he thinks American people's hearts and minds are at right now.
In our last 30 seconds or so, Congresswoman, I know you have school-age kids. You're working from home with them. You're thinking about other families who are having that experience right now. What's your message to people?
You know, we've all had to adjust our lifestyles. And I understand intimately well how challenging it can be. You know, my 72-year-old mom used to help with my young daughters who are 5 and 9. But she's home with my dad. He has MS, and it's so important that we cease interaction outside of our daily FaceTimes with our family. And so juggling work and children who are home for school is challenging, but it is so necessary to protect the health of our community and our loved ones. So hang in there. The more we do this now, the better off we're going to be and the faster we'll be through this.
Massachusetts Congresswoman Lori Trahan, our thoughts will be with your family. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Listening in that conversation was WBUR senior Washington correspondent Kimberly Atkins, who joins us now to reflect on it. Welcome back, Kimberly.
Hi, Tiziana.
So let me just ask you what stuck out to you about what Congresswoman Lori Trahan said.
Well, I think it just shows how fast moving this entire story is. The fact that there are lawmakers now openly, for example, calling for a nationwide stay at home order of the magnitude that you see in places like India right now, that is doing that, saying that that is really the only way to slow this. And the stark contrast with the White House, as you mentioned, where the president seems very eager to what, as he calls it, reopen the country and really shut down many of the stay-at-home orders that have been implemented community to community and state to state. So it just shows how quickly things move and quickly things change.
So what was the reaction in Washington to the president yesterday saying he wants the country raring to go by Easter?
Yeah, there hasn't been a lot of people, including most Republicans, who are on board with that. There seems to be people seem to be listening to the president's experts, most of whom pointed out that the spread of this disease is different in different places. We've heard from Governor Cuomo in New York talk about how, because of the dense population in New York City, we're really seeing a hotspot there, but things are different in other places. We've seen health experts say that perhaps if there is testing for people for the antibody, if people have been cured of it, perhaps they can slowly start to go back to work. But it's very complicated, and it's not a one-size-fits-all solution that the president advocates, and people seem to be moving in a much more cautious way.
Kimberly, I know we've all been aware that virus symptoms have begun to spread across Congress. Still, it was really a moment, very striking to hear today that Massachusetts Congressman Seth Moulton is showing symptoms and is self-quarantining without a test. What are the implications of that for the Massachusetts congressional delegation?
Yeah, it just shows the peril of the fact that these lawmakers very well may have to go back to Washington, gather together, taking all precautions that they can to cast a vote on this massive stimulus bill. There has not been a way to do remote voting, as you noted with Congresswoman Trahan. What Congress may be able to do is pass these bills via unanimous consent, which means that there actually isn't a roll call vote, but it only takes one person to object to that, one member, and then they would have to do it in a roll call vote. And we don't know where we are now. There's still some contention over this bill, so that's very possible, although leaders are working to try to avoid that happening. But it just shows you there are already a lot of people self-quarantining. People have asked, for example, in New York City, anyone who's been to New York City to self-quarantine for 14 days. So it makes it very, very difficult for these lawmakers to get back to try to stay safe. Both Congressman Moulton and his wife are experiencing symptoms, and they have an 18-year-old daughter who they said so far doesn't have any. But it just shows you how personal this is for everyone.
And in our last 15 or 20 seconds, Kimberly, do you think the Senate will get to a vote on this stimulus package quickly, or is there now a sticky wicket?
Nothing in Congress moves quickly, and that's one of the problems with this, is by the time Congress acts, there's already a new need. So this seems to be Congress being Congress, despite the fact that the need is so urgent and fast.
All right, WBUR Senior Washington Correspondent Kimberly Atkins, thanks so much.
Good to talk to you.
This is the segment of our program where we take your coronavirus calls with our healthcare experts. You can call with your questions at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. What do you want to know about symptoms, contagion, self-protection, staying at home, care for loved ones and family members? Call with those questions. On the line to help us is Dr. Michael Stein, a primary care physician and professor and chair of health policy at the Boston University School of Public Health. He's also co-author of a new book called Pained, Uncomfortable Conversations About the Public's Health. Welcome to Radio Boston, Dr. Stein.
Thanks for having me.
We also hope to have joining us in a bit Dr. Davidson Hamer, who is a professor of infectious disease and medicine at the Boston University School of Medicine. These are very fluid times. He's not been able to join us yet, but Dr. Stein, we hope he'll be able to soon.
Great.
And also, Dr. Stein, listeners, we're in an unusual situation today. Every day, Governor Charlie Baker holds a daily press update. Today, it is scheduled for 3:30. We're not sure that'll start on time, but when it starts, we will go to it live. So we're going to take as many calls as we can, get as many questions answered. We'll go at the last second, but I may not get to say a good goodbye to you, Dr. Stein. So let me thank you now again for being here to join us.
Very good. I understand.
And while I'm doing all this introduction, we now have Dr. Davidson Hamer. So welcome to you too, Dr. Hamer.
Thank you very much.
So, Dr. Stein, let me begin by asking you, what are you seeing and how are you today in the face of how this pandemic is changing?
Well, I'm seeing that we're still struggling with the same three issues that we've been dealing with for the past weeks, right? The first one being, how do we keep physically separate? How do we do that in a uniform and universal way? That's number one. Number two is, how do we test the population? And number three is, how do we keep our healthcare workers healthy so that they can go to work and care for people? Those seem to be the three major issues that are staying with us for now.
And Dr. Davidson Hamer, what message do you want to send to elected officials right now, especially in terms of local, state, federal response? What do you need and what message do you want to send?
I think that there's an increasing need for personal protective equipment and really helping major healthcare centers with making sure they're going to have ample supplies over the next few weeks. I mean, it looks like the sort of epidemic curve is really starting to take off in Boston. I've been in touch with colleagues in New York, and they are really being hit hard. We anticipate we're around 8 to 10 days behind New York City and other parts of New York. So it's going to be even harder. And already many hospitals are running short on some basic supplies to protect healthcare workers. And then the testing issue, which Dr. Stein mentioned, has been a problem. It's getting better. It's still not optimal. And I think that there's a need for more testing kits for all the hospitals and other facilities that are running COVID-19 tests.
Dr. Stein, we are in a healthcare-rich environment here in Greater Boston. We are all watching what's unfolding in New York and hearing Governor Andrew Cuomo's concern that capacity, equipment, supplies are not up to the spike that the state is facing. Are we on the same trajectory, and will we fall short at the same level that he's saying he's concerned New York will fall short? Or does this healthcare-rich environment give us the ability to handle that spike more effectively?
I think it's very hard to know what these curves look like, right? I mean, we have a variety of different curves. We have the curve of tests that are positive. We have a curve of actual new infections, which is a little bit different from the tests, which are really just a window on the past several weeks of infections. We have a curve of hospitalizations and a curve of ICU beds. So it really depends on each what curve you're talking about. I think that I'd like to just reinforce the message again that, you know, time is lives here, and the time that we can do everything we can to protect ourselves is now. It was before. Earlier, we've been living in that time. But, you know, anything that we can do, I think, saves hospital beds, ICU beds, and that's the best we can do to bend at least the hospital curve for now.
Thanks for that, Dr. Stein. I'm going to turn to Dr. Hamer for a minute here. We were having a little trouble with your line there. I don't know if there's anything that we can do with that. But let me turn to Dr. Hamer for just a second. There has been a question as to whether Governor Charlie Baker's stay-at-home advisory is sufficient given the moves by some other states to really order a shelter in place with law enforcement consequences for violating that. Is a stay-at-home advisory sufficient to keep enough social distancing to help us flatten this curve in your from your perspective or in your opinion?
I think that if people adhere to this recommendation, that it should be an adequate. And I think that at least in some parts of the city and in Cambridge where I live, you know, the streets are pretty empty. And so I think there's, you know, the only people going out are, you know, those that have dogs to walk and then people that may be, you know, going out to do, you know, necessary errands for food and medical supplies and so forth. So I think if people adhere to it and really try to minimize socializing, stay at home most of the time other than really urgent errands, that should work. Can I actually just go back to your first question, though, and
yes,
add a couple additional comments?
So absolutely.
There's a couple things. You know, one is in China and in Seoul, South Korea, and other parts of South Korea, they had to very rapidly scale up isolation hospitals and special places to keep people. And there's some work like that being planned for Boston. But I think, and actually now New York is going that same direction. So the state and really the city health authorities are, you know, I think they're working on this, but this is something that really is going to, may need to be done. If we really have a massive surge in cases, we want to get the milder cases ideally out of their homes so they don't infect you know, family members or roommates. Where possible, obviously it may not be feasible to break up, you know, families with young children and keep people isolated, but have sort of a place for milder patients to be until they recover from symptoms and try and reserve hospital beds for those that are sicker. There's going to be a need to expand hospital level beds, and there's a lot of work being done on that. But in an ideal world, it would really be great to be able to do contact tracing, to identify those who are infected, figure out who they've been in touch with, and then contact those people and ideally test them. This has been done in both, actually it was done in China as well as Singapore, and I think in South Korea as well, as an effective sort of addition to sort of the stay-at-home strategies that are being used.
I'm going to turn to calls now, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And just a reminder to everyone that we are now awaiting a live press conference from Massachusetts Governor Charlie Baker, and when that begins, I'm going to have to cut out fairly abruptly and bring us over to that press conference, so my apologies in advance for that. We've got Barbara on the line from Jamaica Plain. Barbara, please go ahead.
Thanks for taking my call. I understand the 2-week quarantine if people are infected or even if they're asymptomatic. I guess my question is, after those 2 weeks that pass, even though they may not be contagious anymore, has the virus run its course and are they free and clear?
Dr. Stein.
As best we know, the great majority, and I'll let Professor Hamer speak to this as well, as best we know that after 2 weeks, nearly everybody should be free and clear. That may not be 100%, but that's certainly the great, great, great majority of people.
So, Dr. Stein, what would make one think, okay, it's been 2 weeks, but perhaps I'm not free and clear? What would that look like, you know, so somebody could check themselves?
I don't think it would look like anything. That is, if you're asymptomatic during that entire time, you wouldn't know if you were free or clear without getting tested. So it's very difficult for the individual to know that. Certainly, if they develop symptoms late, they would enter another period where they would have to self-quarantine and perhaps get tested if they can get testing.
And Dr. Hamer, is there anything you want to add to that?
No, I think that's pretty accurate. I mean, I think that for somebody who's completely asymptomatic, we don't really have good evidence yet how long they're shedding virus. But for those who are sick with milder illness, you know, on average, most people clear virus by days 12 to 14 after onset of symptoms. So extrapolating from that, we can assume that the majority of people that have mild or subclinical infections should be cleared by 2 weeks.
Okay.
It's a different situation with sicker patients in the hospital because there's evidence they can shed virus both in their nasopharynx and actually sometimes in their feces for up to 3 weeks or more.
Dr. Hamer, I do want to double back to you because you talked about contact tracing. I think that's the term that you used.
Yes.
And the question that comes up with that is, in a Western democracy with the level of privacy laws that we have, is it possible, is it legal, is it viable to do the kinds of levels of contact tracing that you're talking about, or is that kind of inconsistent with our practice and culture here in the United States?
That's a good question, and I can't. I mean, I think it is. We definitely would have limits in being able to do this as effectively as a city state like Singapore, for example, where they're actually using cell phones and other modalities to track all contacts. But that said, we actually do have contact tracing programs in place in Massachusetts that we use for people that have been exposed to somebody with tuberculosis. So I think there is some sort of legal framework to do this in a very different context.
Yes, indeed. There is. I mean, the public health authorities have broad reach to do contact tracing in situations like this. So you should expect to be contact traced. The issue is when you have community-wide spread, we don't have the resources or person power to go out and do all the tracing that really needs to be done, either by phone or in person. So I remember Wuhan, which really shut things down, was full population-wide mandatory testing, plus contact tracing, plus aggressive quarantining. So it really takes all three of those elements, and here we're in trouble because we're behind in the numbers at this point, and we just don't have the personnel to go out and do this. This would be a great group of people to train volunteers because people can do this at this point if there were enough of the contact tracers.
We are going to go now to Governor Charlie Baker, who's holding a live press conference.
Dr. Gottlieb, Dr. Walensky, Dr. Bittinger, Dr. Wagner, and Dr. Lander together have dozens and dozens of years of experience in public health and infectious disease. And I want to start by saying that I know I speak for all of us when I say how grateful we are to have them on board. In addition, we've been joined on that advisory board by Scott Gottlieb, who I think many people know served as the head of FDA until about a year ago and brings not only a tremendous amount of clinical and public health and infectious disease knowledge to this, but also a deep understanding of Washington. The group's been advising the command center on expanding access to testing and planning for the medical surge. You've heard me say many times before that we're fortunate that Massachusetts is home to leading healthcare and educational institutions. With some of the brightest minds in medicine in our own backyard, we're grateful that this group is supporting our strategic efforts to respond to the COVID-19 outbreak. I want to switch gears briefly here and talk a little bit about our plans with respect to schools. 10 days ago, most people know that we ordered a 3-week suspension of school operations at all public and private K-12 schools in Massachusetts from March 17th until April 6th. Today, we are issuing an order, I just signed it, that will order all schools and all non-emergency child care programs to remain closed through the end of April, reopening no sooner than Monday, May 4. This will allow school districts to provide the best possible opportunities for remote learning to all students. Now, we want to be clear on this, and Commissioner Riley will speak a little bit about this in a minute. This is not an extended school vacation. During this long-term closure, the Department of Elementary and Secondary Education will work with school districts to further develop educational programming students can use at home. This way, schools can prepare for their students' return in May. This extended closure will allow more time for teachers to ensure that all students have access to resources and instruction that is customized to their particular needs. This includes students with special needs and English language learners. And most importantly, this time period provides a runway to ensure that they can complete their coursework by the end of the school year in June. We all know that across the state, school administrators, principals, and teachers have worked hard to give students the tools they need to continue their learning. We know it's been difficult to be apart from students and to come up with creative ways to teach them. We also understand how hard parents are working to keep their children engaged in the learning process. Teachers, districts, and parents are getting creative and doing everything they can to ensure that their kids don't fall behind and that they stay engaged. On behalf of all of us, I just want to say thank you because this matters. And to help in this effort, our administration is partnering with WGBH to launch online educational resources for kids across Massachusetts. WGBH will also televise educational content between noon and 5 p.m. Monday through Friday because they and we understand that not every district and not every student has the same access to computers, the internet, and tablets. The department will also work with school districts to encourage interactive ways of learning, like exploring nature and participating in activities that incorporate social distancing. There's more work to do, obviously, and we will continue to make progress toward helping all schools have the tools and the materials that they need. As I said before, we're also extending closures for non-emergency childcare programs to May 4th as well. Emergency child care programs will continue to serve health care workers, first responders, and other essential personnel who must continue to work, and this does include grocery store workers. As of yesterday, the department had approved over 400 programs with the capacity to serve more than 8,000 children. We're amazed that so many providers have stepped up to partner with our Department of Early Education as part of this initiative. It's important to remember that these programs are for emergency workers and essential personnel only, and that they're designed to provide drive up, pick up, and drop in service. I want to thank the team at the Department of Education, and especially the folks at the Department of Early Education and all those child care providers for stepping up during these difficult times. They're making it possible for our frontline workers to get to work and to keep us healthy and safe. We're also announcing today new guidance to keep vulnerable families in their homes, preserve the health and safety of low-income renters, homeowners, and prevent homelessness. The Department of Housing and Community Development is issuing guidance that directs owners of state-aided low-income housing, including local housing authorities and affordable housing operators, to suspend all non-emergency evictions. DHCD will suspend any terminations of federal and state rental vouchers under their purview. A new COVID-19 Rental Assistance for Families in Transition, or RAF program, will be set up with Mass Housing to assist families facing rent insecurity during this public health emergency. Mass Housing will contribute $5 million to the RAF program to keep households in stable situations when facing housing emergencies from the loss of income, an increase in expenses, or both. Households experiencing rent insecurity due to the impacts of COVID-19 will be able to apply for financial assistance of up to $4,000. In order for residents to receive this assistance, they can apply through their regional administering agency. And more information on this program can be found at mass.gov/DHCD. The Division of Banks has also issued new guidance to Massachusetts financial institutions and lenders, outlining the steps we expect them to take to provide relief for borrowers. This includes postponing foreclosures for 60 days and refraining from reporting late payments to credit rating agencies for at least 60 days. While we can take these steps immediately today, we're also working with our partners in the legislature on this issue. They're very much aware of the need to protect people from losing their homes and their apartments, and we appreciate working with them on this. With respect to grocery stores, I said yesterday that we are working with the Attorney General and the Department of Public Health to issue a new public health order related to grocery stores and pharmacies. As you all know, they will remain open and are considered an essential service during this state of emergency. As we continue to monitor this outbreak, it's important that these places, which are often visited by large amounts of people on a daily basis, are observing DPH guidance on sanitation and social distancing. We also need to make sure we make appropriate accommodations for our most vulnerable residents so they can safely do their shopping for food and supplies. This order will require grocery stores and pharmacies to provide at least 1 hour a day for adults over 60 years old to shop. Works for me, Jeff. What do you think? How about you?
Not there yet, sir.
Not there yet. Okay. We also are going to require grocery stores and pharmacies to offer a host of sanitation options like hand sanitizer and disinfecting wipes as they are available to clean shopping carts and point of frequent contact. Procedures to ensure that both employees and customers remain at least 6 feet apart at all times. This should include a marked social distancing line which begins 6 feet away from all checkout counters and closure of any self-served food stations. This order also instructs store employees to stay home if they are not feeling well and requests that stores accommodate employees who fall into the high-risk populations to do an alternative assignment with less exposure. In addition, from now on, reusable bags are prohibited and all regulations on plastic bag bans will be lifted. Finally, stores are not allowed to charge for paper and plastic bags at this time. As we continue to make adjustments and navigate these uncertain and challenging times, I just want to say on behalf of the administration and so many others how grateful we are that so many people are stepping up to help one another. Whether it's staying at home to avoid spreading the virus, which is absolutely critical to our success in bending the trend, or checking in on their neighbors, or maybe their parents, or their grandparents, everyone has a part to play in this. And so far, there's no doubt the people of Massachusetts are meeting this challenge head on. There's a lot left to do, but we are all in this together, and we hope you all appreciate how grateful we are for the people of Massachusetts' decision and desire to do all they can to make sure they keep themselves, their families, their neighbors, and their communities and the Commonwealth safe. I want to close once again by reminding everyone that it's important that residents stay up to date with the latest information from trusted sources. Visit mass.gov/COVID-19, call 211 with questions, sign up for the new text updates by texting COVID-MA to 888-777, and get your news from reliable news sources like TV stations and newspapers. Thank you. That, Jeff, Commissioner Riley, would you like to say a few words?
Good afternoon, everyone. Our focus as an educational community during this challenging time is on the needs of our students, especially our most vulnerable students. We have made sure to prioritize student safety, both physical and emotional, as well as nutrition. For example, we have almost 1,200 sites up and running to feed our kids. Today's proactive announcement from the governor to extend the school closure order until May 4th further allows us to keep our kids safe while building in additional planning time needed for a longer-term closure. To that end, we at the department will be sending out additional guidance to districts tomorrow morning. This guidance was developed after speaking with and listening to many stakeholders in our educational community and should be used by districts to build upon or harmonize with their current remote learning plans. Our expectation is that districts will be implementing these revised plans by early April. It is important to note that we are all in this together, working on behalf of our children. There is much to do. The governor spoke about GBH and the amazing partnership we have, but we know that working together, we can get through this. Thank you very much.
Let me just start by saying, do you have questions specifically for the commissioner on the school stuff?
What should
So I think our advice in the beginning has been, we recognize this is a traumatic time for our kids and that we want to get them settled, and then we want to get them in a routine. And so we're going to be providing guidance tomorrow about what that routine could look like. We recognize districts will have the ability to kind of customize their plans for their communities, but we're going to offer some structure by which to focus on that for. And so we think getting kids into a routine, keeping them engaged in learning, is the way to go. This is an amazing opportunity to think about project-based learning, to think about reading a book, to think about cooking recipes and how that works, to think about starting a garden. We have a real opportunity here to do different things with our children, and we're going to try to supply the resources in addition to what the district is offering. So people have asked about the MCAS, and what I want to say is I want to be both respectful of federal and state laws and lawmakers. And what I mean by that is I think we need to wait first until we see if we get the federal waiver, which we have applied for, around testing. And then we need to wait and see if the state legislation that was sent up by the administration yesterday will grant me the authority to make such decisions. You should expect that once those hurdles are cleared, that I will make decisions in short order about the MCAS.
Commissioner, to that end, are there any additional resources for families who do not have computers at home or who not even have broadband?
Thank you for the question. We're going to be sending out a letter to families regarding this very issue. Part of the reason why we partnered with GBH is we recognize that not all children at this time have access to a computer or broadband, and we thought that television was one way we could reach kids, in addition to what districts are doing. Many districts are doing pencil and paper versions, reading lists, packets of materials, and things like that. We think that districts should use whatever they have at their availability to get out to kids, but we want to make sure that we don't penalize any children that don't have access to the Internet.
Hearing from districts are the biggest challenges they're facing bringing remote learning.
You know, I think we're hearing that this is an issue where some people have already gone in a direction towards online learning and some people haven't. When we talk about remote learning, we're talking about learning from home. It could be on the online version or not. But when we hear from districts, what we're hearing is everyone's trying to make their own individual plan based on the resources and assets that they have. What we're trying to do is support them, get them as many resources as possible, as well as try to pull people together to see what additional supports and resources we can get out to our people in the field. So I really want to be respectful of the families and send it to them first. We will make it available to you once it gets sent out. You know, we try to do this thing step by step.
Are students going to be disadvantaged by all of this? Are we going to have a graduating class that is less prepared for college because they've been distance learning?
I think only time is going to tell on what happens. This could be an amazing opportunity to think differently about how we educate our kids and think about real-world applications, using social distancing, of course, right? This could be something new that could give us additional information about how kids learn best. We won't know, but it's certainly something we're looking at.
Thank you, Commissioner. Let's see if we got any questions.
Thank you.
The one thing I would add to what the Commissioner said, the Lieutenant Governor and I have been big supporters of a number of applied learning programs, some of which are available already in many of our elementary, middle, and high schools, some of which are available at our vocational schools, and some of which are available through partnerships with private entities that offer this sort of thing. But I'll say this. I have seen how excited and how important project-based learning and applied learning can be for kids. A lot of the stuff that the STEM Council, which the Lieutenant Governor co-chairs, has been up to, has been all about creating project-based learning and applied learning opportunities for students. And if you talk to a lot of the kids in the vocational schools, the first thing they say about what they like most about being there is the opportunity to apply what they're learning in class directly with something that involves a trade, computer science, whatever it might be. And I think the commissioner's right. If people really choose to embrace this, and it's not easy, there's an opportunity here to do some very different things with respect to educating and encouraging kids. And we certainly hope that ends up being where this goes.
Governor, your thoughts on the stimulus package being debated in Washington, and are those figures $1,200, $2,400, is that enough money for Massachusetts residents, especially where rent can be high and rents are coming up?
So there, first of all, we've issued a whole series of guidance and directives and orders around renters and homeowners, and we're going to continue to do that. And as I've said many times, we are going to play a very aggressive game with respect to making sure people don't lose their place of residence as a result of this current circumstance, and we are going to work with the legislature on anything else they think we need to do with regard to that. As far as the package itself is concerned, I've been on three calls today. The Lieutenant Governor and I were on two of them, and some of them were with federal officials, some of them were with legislative folks, and some of them were with other governors. And I wouldn't call this thing still a work in progress, because clearly it's mostly done at this point. I think they're going through what they call the final technical review to make sure that, you know, this doesn't contradict that, and this isn't against the law, and blah, 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 blah. But it basically breaks down into sort of five or six components. One is direct aid to individuals. One is a supplement with respect to unemployment insurance. One is a significant amount of money to healthcare providers. One is a significant amount of money to states. And the final one is a significant amount of resources to municipalities. And I'm not going to give you any details on the numbers on that, because they're all floating around all over the place. But the bottom line is they really picked, and then there's a very significant package for small businesses. So that's really, I mean, if you had to think about this thing, they basically broke it up into six big categories, and each of those categories, they funded a variety of relief in a number of different ways. Beyond that, I think, until we see the finished product, it would be hard to speak to it in more detail than that. Well, first of all, I know I speak for everybody in our administration when I say we share their frustration and dismay with all the issues associated with personal protective equipment. I was the first governor to point out to the administration that they were competing directly with us in our efforts to purchase gear for healthcare workers and first responders here in Massachusetts, and was told at the time that they wouldn't do that anymore. But I can tell you, on the call I was just on with a whole host of other governors, numerous governors raised this as a huge problem with respect to their ability to meet the needs and expectations and legitimate concerns of the healthcare workers and first responders in their communities. We continue to chase this stuff through a variety of means. One way is through the stockpile, which we are getting orders from, and we are sending stuff out to the field as we get it. The second is domestic procurements with U.S.-based companies and corporations. And the third is international pursuits of gear and equipment, which we also continue to pursue. But one of the most fundamental elements to all of this, I think, for every governor and every state and every provider and every first responder, is this issue of being able to actually close on deals where we make orders, those orders get confirmed, and they need to happen. This is a source of enormous frustration for all of us. On the testing piece, we said we needed to get up to at least 3,500 tests a day, and we said we would be there by this week. We're going to be there this week for real, and we're going to stay there and probably significantly exceed that number on a go-forward basis. As that happens, we said before, we will find more people who test positive because we are going to be testing far more people than we were testing 2 weeks ago. That's a good thing because it's going to make it possible for us to do the isolation and the tracing and the tracking work that everybody believes is fundamental to anybody's ability to succeed in both preparing for the surge and also limiting the spread.
You're listening to live coverage of Governor Charlie Baker's daily press update on the coronavirus coverage from Radio Boston.
We spent a lot of time with the public health folks in developing those guidance, that guidance, and we've heard from many people since we issued those this morning that they really appreciate them and they look forward to implementing them. There's no question that if people are going to be working on construction on job sites, they need to have access to sinks, warm water, hand sanitizer, and a commitment to implementing the physical distancing and the social distancing that we've all been talking about. There's a lot to those guidance, to those guidances and those recommendations and those requirements, and local communities have made clear to us that they look forward to ensuring that the sites in their communities that are engaged in that activity live up to those standards. And if they don't, they'll do something about it, which is exactly as it should be. Well, as we've said many times, if you feel sick, don't go to work. I mean, I can't say that enough. There have been numerous instances that have taken place. This is anecdotal, but all of us know people, God bless them, who felt sick, didn't stay home, went to work, and then a day or two after they'd gone to work, got tested and tested positive. You know, there are some very basic things that we all need to keep in mind here, okay? Number one is if you feel sick, don't go to work, okay? Call your healthcare provider. Remember, telehealth is now a covered benefit in Massachusetts. If you call your provider and you talk to your provider over the phone or you engage them in a video chat, they're going to get reimbursed for doing that. It's really important that people understand that if you feel sick, don't go to work. Call your provider. And if you develop the symptoms that we're talking about, associated with COVID-19, which are flu-like symptoms, because we've ramped up our testing capacity and dramatically expanded the number of outlets that are available to conduct these tests, people should be able to get tested. But that is the number one way to keep everybody at work in an essential business safe. Don't go to work if you feel sick. Second thing is, please continue to follow all the rules we've talked about with respect to our stay-at-home advisory, non-essential visits with families and friends, the stuff that people really need to take to heart and recognize as purposeful in our ability to limit spread. And third, hygiene. Wipe surfaces. Wash your hands. Hand sanitizer. Do all those things that people have been talking about. And with respect to construction, follow the rules associated with the guidance that we issued and recognize and understand that cities and towns are going to enforce that guidance, which is appropriate.
This is WBUR's Radio Boston, and you've been listening live to Massachusetts Governor Charlie Baker in a daily briefing from the State House. WBUR's Steve Brown was also listening. Hello there, Steve.
Hi, Tiziana.
Hi, Steve. Maybe you can give our listeners the headlines because there were several significant announcements that the governor made today.
Sure. The big one is that he is extending the closure of schools in Massachusetts through the end of April, saying that schools in Massachusetts should reopen on May 4th. Obviously, that depends on what happens with this coronavirus over the next couple of months. They could obviously extend it beyond that if need be. But as of right now, the schools in Massachusetts will all remain closed until May 4th. He reiterated this is not a vacation. This will give educators some time to give more runway to complete the coursework by the end of the year. He also said that they're partnering with Channel 2 and Channel 44 to provide some programming on TV that students can tune into during the day between noon and 5 o'clock, and get an idea of or have some additional educational programming sent their way. Also, this applies to the closure until May 4th, applies to child care programs, except for the about 400 programs that are open to serve emergency cases, those being parents or children of parents who are first responders or in the medical community. The governor said there's 400 programs that are serving 8,000 children right now. They're also taking some steps to make sure that people can stay in their homes. They're setting up a program to help families facing rent insecurity that they can apply and get some money to make sure that they can stay in their homes. He's also recommending to banks that they take steps to postpone foreclosures and not to report any late payments to credit rating services. He's also asking supermarkets to do some things. Supermarkets and pharmacies, obviously, they remain open, but the state is going to require that those places provide 1 hour a day for people over the age of 60 or anyone who is at risk of health issues, that there would be an hour a day set aside that those people can go. Also, they're banning the reusable bags. We've all learned to bring those bags in and reuse them. We won't be able to do that anymore, at least for the time being. And they're lifting all the prohibition on plastic bags and paper bags, and requiring that the supermarkets or grocery stores cannot charge you for those bags.
Steve, that was great. I'm going to have to take it back from you here. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So you've been listening to live coverage of Governor Charlie Baker, and that is our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR. I'm Tiziana Deering. I hope you'll join us again tomorrow. Next up, WBUR's All Things Considered.